The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Microphone set here. I should put a picture of this up. It's really a nice microphone. Everybody seems to be using the Shure, which is a very good one. SM2, I think they're using now. I used one for a while. And I got this beauty from, well, the mid-1940s. RCA BX. It's a great one. Okay. We're going to take a look here. Let me do one thing. Hold on just a second. I want to see what's being admitted to here on the coverage online. Here, blast. There, let's see what comes up. All right, well, Port Chicago Naval Magazine explosion. Looks promising. The cover-up on this has been huge. The Port Chicago atomic bomb explosion, nuclear explosion, July 18th, 2024. This is the date of the publication. On the evening of 17 July 1944, disaster struck. Two cargo ships, and they're named, were berthed at the munitions pier at Port Chicago. And let me see if they're jumping me a page up here. Hold on here. Is it going to tell me? No, it's not. This is a good article, though. Maybe I'll put this up as well. All right, here. The two ships were berthed at the munitions pier, Port Chicago, which is about 30 miles inland in the San Francisco Bay, that whole complex of natural formations and all kinds of places for ships to anchor and port activities and so forth. The two cargo ships were berthed at the munitions pier. They were apparently using that staging area for transporting bombs, ammunition, and all the rest to the Pacific War Theater. This is July of 1944, a little over a year left in the Pacific War. The latter of the two vessels was being loaded with a variety of munitions. In the holds of the E.A. Bryan, or on the pier ready to be loaded, were 4,606 tons of anti-aircraft ammunition, aerial bombs, high explosives, and smokeless powder. Another 429 tons were still in 16 rail cars on the pier, awaiting transfer to both ships. According to witness statements, at 10:18 p.m. at night, a dull clang, possibly caused by a falling cargo boom and a sound of splintering wood, preceded a blinding flash and heavy detonation on the pier, followed within seconds by a smaller detonation and then others, and then the massive explosion of munitions in the E.A. Bryant's holds. The ship, most of the pier, all structures within a 1,000-foot radius, and many of the flat cars on the rail line disintegrated. They were just gone. The explosion blew one of the ships, the Quinault Victory, into large pieces that sank in the water of S-U-I-S-U-N. Suisun? Suisun? We'll find out. Bay. A U.S. Coast Guard fire barge was blown away from the munitions pier and sank, taking its five-man crew with it. 320 individuals in the immediate proximity of the blasts, Navy personnel on the loading details, a Marine Corps sentry, the ship's Navy armed guard and merchant marine crews, and civilian employees were all killed instantaneously. Of these, the remains of only 51 were identifiable afterward. There's a big angle to this. African-American sailors comprised nearly two-thirds of those killed. More than 250 other personnel at the Port Chicago facility were injured. A number of seriously wounded, obviously, never recovered fully. This is a big thing. We're going to find out more about this. With us this first hour, our first guest tonight, is an expert in this field. He has spent many years studying this, and we've got some really good information under his name in guests as well. And I hope you can all pull up this data and look at it later on tonight. Walter Wilkinson is standing by now, and one of the entries under his name is a Treasury of Port Chicago data, and that is really something. Walter, if you put that together, you did a heck of a job. It's great. Welcome.
Thanks, Jeff. I've been listening to your show for more than 20 years now. I remember Sherman Skolnick era and the Walter Burian era, and even further back than that. So thank you for all the good work you've been doing. I know you've only been receiving a smidgen of the acknowledgement you deserve.
Well, thank you for that. It's very kind. Thank you. Thank you, Walter. Now, Port Chicago, 1944. This was covered up. And the big question, there are two issues here. Was it a nuclear explosion? And was there any racism involved with the U.S. Navy, who had so many blacks doing this very dangerous and deadly work? Those are the two primary questions I'm familiar with. But let's take it from the top and just lead us through, and we'll kind of enjoy the ride with you. Go ahead, if you would.
Okay, well, as you mentioned, the time and date was July 18th, 1944. World War II was still going on in the Pacific, not so much in Europe.
Right.
And at 10, 17, or 18 p.m., the eastern part of San Francisco Bay was rocked with a huge explosion, which was estimated to be the most powerful explosion in the history of North America. And the explosion had none of the characteristics of conventional shells and bombs and munitions going off, and every single characteristic of an atom bomb going off.
Uh-huh.
Now, the problem with that, of course, is that the first test of an atom bomb was at White Sands, New Mexico, 364 days later. So
yes, there's a little bit of a lapse there, isn't there? That's one of the more...
Just a bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, a thing which makes this so timely is that movie from last year called Oppenheimer. Did you see it, Jeff?
No, I did not, but I'm certainly familiar with it and what they like about it and what they don't like about it. But yes, it's an interesting story, and I'm sure, without even seeing it, and I think you may agree just going into this, I don't know how you feel, but it sounds like they left a big part of the story out. I don't know.
Absolutely. It's more than 3 hours long. So far, I've seen the first 5 minutes of it from Amazon Prime Video.
Uh-huh.
And the first 5 minutes is actually surprisingly hard-hitting in terms of historical realities, which usually haven't been mentioned, but that movie was a complete blockbuster, which was nominated for 13 Academy Awards, which is an all-time high. In terms of box office sales, it is the most successful movie in history, which was a biography. It's also
I had no idea. No idea. Wow.
Yeah. It's also the for World War II movies, it's in the number one position now. It's gone ahead of what was it? The I can't think of it. The English
what, the Battle of Midway?
I can't think of it. The
oh, British, Saving Private Ryan, maybe?
No.
All right.
Anyway, but so.
All right. Well, let me ask you one thing. The first 5 minutes, and it's 3 hours long. I think it's safe to say that this movie served its makers and others in several ways. It certainly will shape history in the minds of hundreds of millions of people who have seen the movie and ultimately will see it. It's rewriting history, is it not?
Exactly. That's why I'm so interested in this. And I was a little surprised there was going to be a movie made about this in the first place, because it's been done before. There was a 7-part miniseries in the past, and I remember very well a PBS Frontline program, a documentary from many years ago. Mm-hmm. And there are others, but I'm sure the thing they all have in common is that there's a dramatic climax at some point, which is going to be at White Sands, New Mexico, when supposedly the first atom bomb was tested. Mm-hmm. And we can imagine the actors, you know, being directed to act very nervous and anticipatory, because this was going to change history, because and some of them thought it wouldn't go off and it would just fizzle. But all of that drama is false, because they all knew that the atom bomb had been successfully tested a year earlier in San Francisco Bay. So
that's quite a statement, my friend, and I'm right with you on it, believe me. So let's go ahead. This is fascinating.
And you're exactly on target that hundreds of millions of people would have this false history reinforced in their minds because of the movie. So the evidence showing to it being a atom bomb test is very, very strong, and it's multidimensional. And one of the things I'm particularly interested in is that there was some movie footage shot of the Port Chicago explosion happening. And I remember seeing it, so it was about the year 2000 or so. So it was online somewhere in the earlier part of the internet.
It's been scrubbed and now. I'm sure it's gone.
Well, very recently I came into possession of a very useful tidbit of information, which is not available anywhere online. So I'll mention it now and hope that someone in your audience might carry this forward.
Okay.
But the great name in this line of research is Peter Vogel. And Vogel is an American. If he's still alive today, he's 87 years old. But I haven't been able to find an obituary of him. So I assume he's still among the living, probably in New Mexico somewhere. And Vogel researched this topic for 35 years. And around the year 2000 or so, he wrote a book called Last Wave from Port Chicago. And it is the ultra classic of Port Chicago research. And it never had a print edition. And this was a little before the era of e-books. So when he was giving it away from his website as a PDF download, but when his website became defunct, it became basically not available. the course of 20 years, I tried a bunch of times to track down even one copy of Peter Vogel's Last Wave from Port Chicago.
You found a copy.
I found a copy, and I had listened to your earlier show a few weeks ago about Port Chicago, which startled me. And I thought, okay, I'm going to give it one more try. And I was able to find that the book is included in a cache of about 20 extremely important Port Chicago documents. And there isn't any author who takes credit for putting this cache of documents together, but I assume it was Peter Vogel himself. And so if that link is on your website...
Well, is it in the treasury of data?
Yes. Yep.
Okay,
yep.
Well, it's there. Yeah, it's up. Just look for a treasury of Port Chicago data right under Walter's name. And what would the title of it be? Let me see if I can find it real quick. It was The Last Wave. You looks like you've actually reproduced much of it. It's all here.
Yeah, it's in 16 chapters of PDF, and yeah, it's all there.
So this is the Holy Grail as far as near as we can get. This is a needle in a haystack you found.
Well, yes, and I have certain skills as a web developer, and I think, I don't know of anyone else who is sort of communicating this, and if I hadn't done this, I don't know that anyone else would, and this... And isn't it ironic? I find it a bit bizarre that the cover-up is about what? It's about the, in its time, the most powerful explosion in the history of North America. And this is the thing they wanted to make disappear. And the effort was very, very nearly successful. And I think the thing about this archive you'll find is that while it's resident on the Internet Archive or Wayback Machine, it is not indexed. And there's so many billions of articles, that's a good way of, squelching something.
Of course.
Because who would find it if it wasn't indexed, you know?
No, you got no title on it. What are you going to do? Good luck. Last Wave, it's right there. You'll see it. Look for this treasury of documents. There's a two-part MP3 interview with Peter Vogel, apparently. Or two different ones, 1999. Those look like very important discoveries as well.
They are. And the radio host was a man named, what's his name? Can't think of it. Anyway, I haven't seen any pictures of Peter Vogel, but I have heard his voice. Uh-huh. And those two... MP3s have a bit of information which I will mention now, which is not available in print anywhere. It's if you listen to those all the way to the end, you will hear Peter Vogel talking about the movie of the Port Chicago explosion, which was made and which now is not available anywhere. And it was Vogel himself who went to the there's a historical center in San Francisco Bay, a sort of memorial about the Port Chicago explosion. And Vogel said, I just can't believe that the U.S. Navy would stage something on such a grand scale without making a movie of it. And the librarian or archivist said, yes, it does exist, but it's on an obsolete film format, which is called nitrate, which is very, very highly flammable.
Yes, very unstable.
And, but the tidbit of information, which is not available anywhere else, is that there was a television station in San Francisco called KQED.
Right.
And Vogel said their technicians were able to transfer it to videotape, and apparently someone took a videotape and digitized it, so you can stream it from the internet, because I saw it in my mind. I remember very clearly, and so it should be possible to if someone is in the Bay Area and maybe they know anyone at KQED, maybe they can see if it would be possible to sort of exhume it. But the first time I mentioned it, well, yeah, it would be more than good. I was impressed by how quickly you picked up on the significance of this, because it could not have been a coincidence. That so what the movie shows is that it's after 10 p.m. and someone had set up a movie camera on the opposite shore of San Francisco Bay, and all is
nearly
quiet.
30 miles away, 20 miles away.
I'm not sure.
A safe distance away, let's put it that way.
Exactly,
now,
yes.
For all of you listening, this is really important. The idea that somebody, obviously the government, set up to film and record this blast in July 1944, a year before the first official test of an A-bomb in New Mexico, the Trinity test. They set up a camera. I am also told, and I don't want to jump ahead of the narrative here, that there is reason to believe, substantial reason to believe, that Franklin D. Roosevelt was brought to the area to observe the blast from a distance. Have you heard that?
Yes.
Of course you have.
Yes, I have, Jeff. And one of the pictures I sent you is a thumbnail of the other really notable book on Port Chicago research, which is by, her name is Daisy Mahern. I sent you a thumbnail to the Amazon. So this is the polar opposite of the last wave from Port Chicago, which has been extremely hard to get a copy of. Anyone can go to Amazon now and get a ebook version of this. And
so, if I might, what we're saying here for all of you out there is rather obvious. There was a prototype atomic bomb put together, a nuclear device. It was ignited in San Francisco Bay. It was filmed, recorded, observed, tracked a year before the official first test ever took place. Now, this may sound heretical to some of you, but the data is, frankly, in my view, overwhelming that it did, in fact, happen. It's no joke.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. Well, it sounds sinister and dark, but it gets several notches worse.
Okay. So, hold on, Walter, if you would, just a minute. We have to take our one break. We'll do that. Come right back. Great layout so far. We'll keep this up. And there are pictures we'll look at as well. And we'll do that when we come back. Hold on. Okay, let's get back to business here. We're learning a lot. This is fascinating. Port Chicago, an intentional ignition of an atomic weapon in our country, killing our people by this alleged government of, by, and for the people. Let me do a little sideline here. This is important, real quick. Germany's last U-boat, that's what they call it anyway, U-234, was sent to Japan from Germany in 1945. Admiral Dönitz, in May of 1945, ordered all U-boats at sea to surrender to the Allies, and hostilities supposedly ended at that point. Now, the U-234 was met by American naval vessels, escorted to port in the U.S., in New Hampshire, Portsmouth to be exact. U-234 had a lot of interesting material. That was an XB boat, the biggest U-boat of all. Huge. They only made six of them, I think. Much of U-234's top secret cargo, 240 tons of documents and war materials, was shipped on to Washington immediately and opened out of sight of the press's cameras. A good deal of what might be expected was there. Armor-piercing, anti-aircraft shells, etc. There were some surprises, though. There were two entire Messerschmitt 262 jet fighters, but the biggest surprise of all came when 10 containers marked Japanese Army were opened. They contained over 560 kilograms of uranium oxide. Now, last note, it was thought about that uranium oxide that it was sent to Oak Ridge and processed at Oak Ridge to help make the fuel for the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. It may have been a German bomb. Think about the irony of that. All right, back to Walter. Go right ahead, my friend. You're doing a great job. Keep it up.
Okay, well, I sent you a picture which piqued your curiosity, I guess, which shows Edward Teller at his office at Los Alamos looking at an unusual format document. And if people were looking at that in front of them, this would be so much more effective.
Okay, go to guests and pull up guests, tonight's guests. Click here, you know where it is. And let me get it to load. Look under Walter's name and look for photos, all right? When you find that, we're ready to go. So I think most people are on it right now. Go ahead, Walter.
Well, okay. I mentioned the great name in this line of research, which is Peter Vogel. And I think he's still alive, probably in New Mexico somewhere. And what a show you could have if you interviewed him. But
oh, my.
It's
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that extraordinary picture, which shows an older Dr. Teller, who was the father of the hydrogen bomb, not the atom bomb, but he was the acknowledged father of the hydrogen bomb.
Right.
And those who are aware of Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece, Dr. Strangelove, which has a subtitle, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Start Loving the Bomb, the character of Dr. Strangelove was played by Peter Sellers, and it's known to be a really savage, scathing satire of Edward Teller. And
Sellers was magnificent in that
yes,
role, by the
yes,
way. Just incredible.
Absolutely. It's a rare movie which gets better every year instead
Amen.
Of getting stale.
Yep.
And so when that picture was taken, the other person in the room was Peter Vogel. He was a photographic expert.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah. Oh, it gets better. Because, okay, this is almost hard to believe, but Vogel attended UC Berkeley back in the Vietnam era. And while he didn't get a degree in some scientific discipline, he did take freshman physics, which is not a really popular course for many
right.
people.
Right.
And it might have multiple hundreds of students in it. And when Vogel was there, there was a very, very special guest professor for freshman physics. And yes, it was Dr. Edward Teller.
That's
teaching.
Amazing.
It is. But the connection is that the Los Alamos Laboratory had an owner or conservator, I don't know the correct term, but that was in fact UC Berkeley. So maybe it's independent now, but at one time Berkeley owned it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one connection. And in fact, if we look at the end of the periodic table of the elements, there are a bunch of elements above which are heavy and only last for a fraction of a second because they only exist inside a cyclotron or particle accelerator. And one of those is called Lawrencium, and that's named after Professor Lawrence at UC Berkeley, who invented the cyclotron.
Lawrence Livermore Labs. Got it.
Yep. And another one is Berkelium, so of course that's Berkeley. And another of them is Californium. So there's one connection. So Peter Vogel was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he says he had a couple of hours to kill. So he dropped by the annual rummage sale of his wife's church, which was some Lutheran church.
Right.
And he has an unusual hobby, which is he collects antique photographic materials and papers. And that's a very unusual hobby, but he says in Paris, in the open-air market, there's one or two stalls which is the world center for this kind of interest. So he says at the rummage sale, there were the things you expect, like used plumbing fixtures and old knickknacks, which people have gotten rid of.
Yeah, but, clothing too, all the rest.
Yep. But there was a cardboard box he saw, which he took a look at the top, and he saw that there were some papers which from the 1940s. So he was interested. This is
what year would this have been that Vogel was at this rummage sale, approximately?
Let's see. I'd have to look it up.
It's all right. Go ahead. No problem.
Yeah, okay. And so he started looking through these unusual papers, mm-hmm. and he got all the way to the bottom, and there was the original of an unusual format sort of poster, which had the title of The History of the 10,000 Ton Gadget. And if you see the picture of Edward Teller at his desk in Los Alamos, he's looking at, in fact, that is the document that Peter Vogel found at the rummage sale. So he found that that there was a photographic technician at Los Alamos in the 1940s whose name he's aware of. He names it in Last Wave from Port Chicago. And because of the unusual format of it, to get copies of it, because it's several 8.5 by 11 inch pages scotch taped together. So they handed off to a photographic technician who squirreled away the original when later.
Right.
And he was a member of the same church. What a bizarre coincidence. And he had donated a box of junk to the rummage sale, and that's how Peter Vogel got his hands on the history of the 10,000-ton gadget.
Of all the people in the world, Vogel is drawn to that. I don't want to get too metaphysical, but I don't think those are always accidents or coincidences. There's other things at work here. He may have been drawn to that. I don't know, but it's just too much of a long shot. It's crazy.
Yeah, I've had that thought. So Vogel had the foresight to pay 25 cents for the box of papers, and he got a written receipt from the church.
Uh-huh.
So he took it home, and it's a lot of tabular data and very advanced calculations. And he was vaguely aware that during the Manhattan Project, the famous scientists, a bit of their slang was to call a gadget was a atom bomb in development. And all the way at the end, the very last line of a table, which it's basically a model of what to expect if a uranium bomb was shot off. And the most important things, of course, were the explosive power and how much radiation, lethal radiation, would be given off. But the very last line refers to how high the smoke column and
the mushroom cloud. How's that?
Yes, yeah. Would be, yes. And it says so many thousands of feet, Allah, Port Chicago. And at the time, Vogel wasn't familiar with that, and so he had to start researching it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, brought him to the story about in World War II. There were 321 Americans who were killed when an ammunition ship blew up in San Francisco Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
But on the surface of it, it seems to be saying that the Port Chicago blast was from a test of an atom bomb a year before the White Sands test. So, next, he able to get an appointment with Dr. Teller at Los Alamos. Hmm. And by that time, he had credentials as a member of scientific advisory boards. So even though he didn't have a degree in any of the sciences, he was a journalist. But his career path is very impressive in that the importance of these scientific advisory panels becomes more and more important, and he was invited to join those. So he was able to use that. He admits to deceiving Dr. Teller. I would say Teller was ambushed. Teller was perhaps out of the limelight at that time, and maybe liked being in the limelight. So maybe he was amenable to sitting down for an interview with anyone who was still interested. So Vogel shows up with a photocopy of the document, history of the 10,000-ton gadget. And 10,000 tons probably refers to kilotons of explosive force of TNT.
Right.
And at first, and Vogel has his 35-millimeter camera, and he says to Teller, "I'm writing an article. Do you mind if I take a picture of you for the article?" And Teller, who comes across as a kind of cranky old man, says, "I've had hundreds of interviews. It doesn't matter at all." So that extraordinary picture you see, this is what's happening. At some point, Vogel says, "You probably don't remember me, Dr. Teller, but I was in your, freshman physics class back in 1966. And Teller said something like, "You're right, young man, I don't remember you at all. What have you got?" So Vogel hands Teller the document. And what you see in that picture, Vogel has taken the picture, and 1 second later, Teller looks up from it in a rage, and he says, "Where did you get this? This is stolen coveted property. I could have you arrested right now."
Wow.
And Vogel explained that, no, he didn't take it out of Los Alamos, someone else did, and he bought it from a third party, and he had a receipt to prove it. Mm-hmm. And Teller got even more angry and said, "Get out of here right now. If you ever say anything about this to anyone, I will deny that this meeting ever took place." But it was already too late because Vogel
had
the picture.
Very smart.
So Teller told him to bring the document around to... Yes, mm-hmm. but on the way out, go to the security desk. And Vogel did, in fact, leave his photocopy behind, and he signed it property of Peter Vogel, and he left in peace. So
he left that photocopy there with Teller. Interesting.
Yes,
very interesting.
And he says that later he donated the original to the Los Alamos archives, which is probably safer for him. Over 35
Do we know
years,
what was briefly? Do we know what was in that document, the original and the photocopy? What did that document say? What was the message? The gist of it?
That when the uranium bomb was set off at White Sands, what to expect.
Got it. Okay.
And part of his research has been trying to track down who was responsible for the document. And there are two names he mentions. One was a British man who was on the Manhattan Project, and after the war, he went back to England and was at the center of Great Britain's first atom bomb, which was tested on an island off the west coast of Australia. And the other guy was this incredibly brilliant man named Hirschfeld, who was from Minnesota, and who is a dual PhD from Princeton.
What a story. What an amazing story. Do we know anything about the specifics of how the Port Chicago atomic bomb was assembled? Anything else about who was behind it? Now, if it's true that FDR was taken there to observe it, and I wouldn't be the least surprised if that is true. I suspect it probably is. At the very least, there is a film of the blast somewhere out there. Now, you've seen that film, correct?
Yes.
How did it look to you when it went off? It was day. It was at night, I guess, right?
Yeah.
10 o'clock at night?
Yeah.
So it'd been dark.
And it's 1944, so it's black and white film. There's no audio.
Yeah.
And for some, the camera is pointed across the bay right at Port Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a flash of bright white light and something, and you see the luminous mushroom cloud. And something which Peter Vogel pointed out, which I think is very important, you can see on that movie footage what's called a Wilson condensation cloud. So when an atom bomb goes off over water, the water is vaporized, but it's forced away from the center of the blast very fast, and it condenses very fast. So there's a eerily symmetrical sort of donut-shaped veil around the place where an atom bomb goes off over water. And he says you can see that in when he saw the movie. And who could believe? So the Navy's explanation was that it was not authentic, and that after the war, in the 1950s, some Hollywood production company was making a documentary about the Port Chicago blast. But for several reasons, that's refutable. One thing being that why would they possibly go to the expense and extra trouble to have an authentic looking Wilson condensation cloud around it?
Now, how would they even create it in those days? That would be almost impossible to do visually.
Yes.
Okay, this is a big story. I don't know how you'd go about trying to find Peter Vogel. Maybe he doesn't want to be found. I would understand that.
Yes.
But if you ever do find him, the door is always open here. I'll do anything I can to facilitate that, Walter. You can come on with him and talk to him. That would be fabulous. And then about the film, where do you think that film might be findable today? Is it something that's out there, possibly?
Yes. The only clue, though, is that the technicians who did the transfer to videotape were at the San Francisco television station, KQED.
KQED, yeah. Well, I'm sure they've been talked to. So,
well,
maybe not, but you never know.
Right.
Have you any ability to go down there to that's a long way, but I don't want to mention cities, but it you might call the station and ask for archives. They might have somebody there who does archiving. I'm sure they do, who would talk to you about this kind of a thing. And
that
you have to get the right person, though. Play it dumb when you call. Just say, I'd like to talk to somebody in archives about an old news story that I'm trying to find that there is footage of. And don't tell them what it is, because that may bring the curtain down real fast. But you might be able to ferret something out that way. You can plan it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'd give that a try.
Yeah, I think you picked up on the significance of this in a moment.
Oh,
that, it would be like an atom bomb being dropped on the cover-up if it became available again, and say it went up on YouTube, or you know, if it was censored from YouTube, it could be on your website or other places, you know?
I'd host it in a second. Then we'd get it out there, and it would be out there and encourage everyone to make copies and so forth. Why do they just leave? Anyhow, I know why. But we need to bring this more forward. You've done great work. This is a wonderful presentation. We have about a minute left. Anything you want to add that is important to get in this conversation?
Well, I found of great interest what you did, that FDR was I think it's probable that he was one of the eyewitnesses at a safe distance.
Yes.
He was dying at that time. His health was terrible, and people were shocked by how bad he looked. But World War II was going on, and he was in Washington. And he took a very unexpected trip to the West Coast.
Surprise.
And while he was ill, while he was very ill, and with a world war going on, he could have had his military people coming to him.
Yeah.
So in his earlier days, FDR had been Secretary of the Navy, and he once said that the Department of the Navy is the one in the government which is nearest to my heart. And he did enjoy watching demonstrations. But
I'll bet you, if you look at his calendar, there'd be some strangeness in it. Yeah.
Oh, yes. And the place to look for this is in the book I sent you a thumbnail a picture of, which is by Daisy Herndon, and it's available from Amazon.com as a Kindle book, and it goes into depth about why FDR's peculiar calendar makes it look like very likely.
So she's into that. Good. This looks like a very important book. In addition to what you've provided to all of us tonight, thank you, and that's the Treasury of Port Chicago Information, which is right under Walter's name. You go through that, look at that. You can hear the radio interview with Peter Vogel. If anybody knows Peter Vogel, invite him. Let me know. He may not want the notoriety. I would understand that, but whatever. We're here to help, and that's what our job is, to bring truth out of the dark and shadows. And good Lord, there's enough of that going on. Daisy Herndon, H-E-R-N-D-O-N, Daisy Herndon, American Nuclear Deception, Why the Port Chicago Experiment Must Be Investigated. Book came out 2 years ago. You'll see it there in the photo page. Thank you very much, Walter, for this. You've been just terrific. And if you'd like to do a follow-up, you have things you didn't get to or we should pursue, let me know and we'll do it. It'd be fun.
Quite a few, including why was Hiroshima and Nagasaki chosen as targets. Deep and sinister, yes. Thank you, Jeff.
Let's do that. Thank you, Walter. I'll be in touch. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, bye.
All right. That's absolutely what journalism is supposed to be, digging up the truth. Fascinating. And the cover-up, huge cover-up. And they used a lot of black Americans in the Navy to be tested. How's that? This is a remarkable story. Okay, be right back with more.